You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting show of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron along with Susan Giddings, and boy, do we have a special show for you today. It's going to be like drinking from a fire hose. So much has been happening with policies and Supreme Court stuff. So without further ado, Susan, what's the first item? Let's go.
Absolutely. It has been quite the month of activity. And of course, you and I have been away for a little bit, so we're in catching up with a lot of information. So the Bureau has put out a ton of policy. We're going to get to that. But they've also put out two, right at the end of the month, they put out two announcements. One of them had to do with release IDs, and one of them had to do with camp transfers. So we'll tackle the easy stuff and move to the hard stuff. So the release ID program, and this is a program for individuals releasing from custody to give them a identification that they can use as part of their transition. As everyone knows, one of the barriers to employment, to housing, to just a lot of things is having proper identification. And this process with the Bureau actually started now several years ago. I was still in custody I was still at central office. And my department was working with, my branch was working with the reentry branch on just how do we pull that together. And when we first started tackling this idea, it was just going to be a different color ID card, right? So those who've been in custody, the standard kind of BOP ID is a photo ID that's a white back with kind of a red overlay. In fact, if you Google Bureau ID, you'll find one. And then we started looking at, well, what's, you know, kind of just taking the existing software that we had, creating a separate ID, maybe putting some additional information on it. And so that it would help folks in that transition. That morphed into what we have today, which is a bona fide ID. The initial thing was going to be literally like a 45, 60 day, when you leave prison, give you time to get to the DMV to get something. Well, that's not always easy, especially if someone doesn't have a valid employment. So, in October of 2023, before I retired, they came out with the new process, and this was, a government printed ID. I had a conversation with someone on the Facebook group a little while ago, and I said, no, it's real ID compliant, and it's not. So I stand corrected on that. But it has many of the components of the real ID requirements, and it doesn't look like kind of a Mickey Mouse or library card. You know, it looks like a genuine identification card. It is accepted. We've had a number of, in fact, when the discussion happened, had a number of individuals who did use it to get on an airplane. TSA does accept it. You're not going to find it on the list of accepted IDs if you go to the TSA page, although they are working with TSA to have that listed as an official identification card, so that even smaller airports, you know, maybe don't get confused, like, what's this? So they're working on that now. But the big change, and I personally was really excited to see this, because this was one of my arguments when we were rolling this out, was you had to have an address, that individuals who were homeless, who didn't have a permanent, you know, or just didn't have a permanent address, they were going to halfway house, maybe they had family support, but they were going to the halfway house with the intent of transitioning to someone else's, to their own place, even though they didn't have one. And the initial rollout did not include that. And myself and some of my colleagues were like, but this is the barrier. not having an identification. And if you're saying someone who's homeless isn't even going to be able to get this ID, like, we're part of the problem, not the solution. And it took some time. And the most recent expansion and is the use of opening it up for individuals who don't have a permanent residence. I haven't gotten the information if they're just going to use, say, the halfway house address as a temporary address. That would be the most logical thing. That is the purpose of halfway house, is to provide that temporary space. So I would think that would be what they would do, but we haven't gotten those details. But I found it interesting, and this is where I'm going to. So while this provides proof of residence, it provides a photo identification that is accepted, it facilitates transportation and travel home. What I found was interesting was they talked about expanding the capacity to produce the cards. And as of 2026, had increased the staffing. Increased staffing has tripled the production output. And they talk about the critical role of the case management coordinator and unit and collaboration with unit management. When I was still working, this was one of my kind of bones I had to pick about the process. The process was being developed outside of the correctional programs branch. It was being developed over in the reentry division. And their strategy at that time, because of course the union was still in place and those barriers to creating new processes, and they were trying to move very quickly. So one of the things they did was they put all of the requirements on management level staff. So the case management coordinator, who in most institutions, there's one, there might be an assistant case management coordinator. At complexes, there's going to be deputy case management coordinators. But this process of taking the photograph and uploading the photograph and doing that work, when the records office, I'm sorry, the receiving and discharge office, the folks that are taking pictures and fingerprints when a person is admitted to custody, and the person who's people that are processing release. So in the case of an institution like where I was at, my last facility, I had a half a dozen staff that were all trained in the use of the equipment to take pictures and photo, you know, take pictures, upload pictures, do the fingerprinting and all of that. And the solution was, oh, we're going to put it on the case management coordinator when we have six staff that do it. It was to avoid dealing with the union. So I would hope that in terms of efficiency and not depending on one staff member, because they're management, therefore they're non-bargaining. So, you know, they didn't need the union to bless it, the process, because it was non-bargaining staff. I would like to see that made more efficient. It makes more sense to have the staff that take pictures regularly to continue to take pictures, but that's my own pet peeve as a prior case management coordinator. Right. But it is a huge step in the right direction. The other big thing that came out, and I've seen some posts on some other Facebook pages and some comments from some other folks in the consulting space that, oh, this isn't a big deal, this isn't new, is this push regarding transferring individuals to camp placement once they have a halfway house or home confinement date. And they're talking about the secure facilities. And if you're familiar with the designation and classification manual, right, there is a section that allows the warden of a main institution to transfer someone to the satellite camp at that facility. And then there's another line in policy, coincidentally, on the next page that said inmates who have been approved for RRC placement, RRC referral, and are otherwise appropriate for camp placement are to be transferred to a camp for an intermediate placement, if at all practical. Yes, it has been in the policy since 2006. You want to guess how often that's used? Well, we've seen
zero.
We saw one of our clients got transferred from a low to a camp recently. It was actually before this policy came out. It's rarely used. One of the issues is historically, we don't transfer people when they're less than a year from release. That not transferring has also kind of been looked at in terms of halfway house transfers as well. What is important is not that it's new. What is important is that the administration at the highest level is saying, this is what you need to do, people, is we need to be looking. Now, there are some qualifiers, and I will share that. So individuals not eligible for camp placement include sex offenders, deportable aliens, disruptive group members, domestic and international terrorists, inmates requiring heightened monitoring, inmates with recent serious misconduct, and cases where placement would pose any identifiable risk to public safety. Now, several of those are like quite obvious and like, yeah, that makes sense. The camp placement that would pose an identifiable risk, you're going to see some folks, some wardens, perhaps some unit teams that are going to see that and go, oh, well, we're not going to because you pose an identifiable risk. Well, any inmate can pose an identifiable risk to include those that are sitting in camp, right? But it makes sense. If we think about what should happen with the classification system, right? A person comes in at a given level and works their way down over time to lesser secured facilities. And with lesser secure facilities come what? More movement, more opportunities to be closer to home, less restrictions. It's normalizing the environment, right? Could you see someone who's been behind a fence for years and all of a sudden transfers to halfway house? Want to talk about the kind of culture shock that happens, yeah. You know, and where all of your movement was controlled. Maybe you only had, you were at an institution with controlled movement at the top and the bottom of the hour. And now you can go where you want within the halfway house, and you can even get passes to leave, and you can go get your hair cut at the local barbershop as opposed to, you know, at the institution barbershop. And if you have a medical appointment, you can go to the doctor on your own. You're not escorted, handcuffed. Because even if you're at a low secure facility, you go handcuffed to a doctor's office. It's those kinds of things that by transitioning to lesser secure facilities is part of that reentry process. It really is part of the process. So I applaud the director for putting this out on Front Street to say, people, we should be doing it. I suspect there's some monitoring at the regional offices and central office levels to see just how much this is actually happening. One of the challenges is that kind of upending the status quo. I watched the deputy director and director, the most recent podcast, and talking about kind of disrupting things and making change happen. And people aren't comfortable with change. So do I think there are unit teams and wardens sitting out there going, well, I mean, I know he's going to halfway house in 6 months, but yeah, he's still low security, and really look for that, well, here's the risk he poses, right? Here's the reason we're not going to do it. And I'm really hoping to see them hold them accountable and start running the rosters. This would have been the kind of directive when I was in the institute, when I was in the regional office, as a senior specialist, you know, I would have been tasked with, okay, run a roster for folks who are designated and are less than 12 months from really, like, we want to know who's moving. And I probably would have had to send an email to the different case management coordinators to say, hey, are you moving this guy? What are you doing with him? And if you're not, why? We did it. You know, I was involved in several initiatives, moving inmates from Lowe's down to camps. And what was the reason they were keeping him in a low? Why weren't they moving him to camp placement? And I will share this one story. I had a case where I was in the region. I had this list. I'm looking at these inmates, and I'm emailing the case management coordinator, and I'm getting these spreadsheets back of why they're not referring them. So then I pick up the phone and I'm like, hey, I need you to explain this to me. And so, like, they had an individual that had a tobacco incident report. Now, Smoking is not permitted in federal prisons. It is a higher level incident report, but it's tobacco, right? It's a cigarette. Why? And it's like, well, he's only had 18 months clear conduct. Ooh. And I'm like, what? And there was another case. The individual had a tobacco shot and said, and he'd been like 2.5 years clear conduct on this tobacco incident report. And I was like, is he not programmed? No, he's programmed. Well, what's the issue? Oh, he has an accepted responsibility for the incident report. I'm like, what do you mean? Well, he says the only reason he got an incident report is because the Bureau has prohibited tobacco in prison. And I'm like, yes, he's right. It's tobacco. Why aren't we moving him to a camp? Like, why are we keeping someone in a low security prison over tobacco? Not drugs, not alcohol, not a weapon, tobacco. So I am very, like I said, I'm very excited to see this out. Yes, it's been in policy. It's been in policy for a decade and nobody's done anything with it. And it's kind of just hung out there. And yeah, it's just kind of hung out there. So I'm glad to see that. Had two recent Supreme Court decisions. And by recent, they were both issued on May 28th, both of them having to do with compassionate release and extraordinary and compelling circumstances. So we've talked about compassionate release before. The law, the way the language in the statute with extraordinary and compelling circumstances, that's all it says. And then you go over to the Sentencing Commission guidelines regarding compassionate release. And that's where it goes into the detail of what compassionate, what is extraordinary and compelling, right? Because the Sentencing Commission is giving instructions to the federal judges, right? And that's why it's not in the statute, but it's in the guidelines, because the sentencing judges use the guidelines from the Sentencing Commission. So, but because the law says extraordinary and compelling and doesn't define it, we often find individuals are attempting to get a compassionate release for different circumstances and kind of push it, like go through the Bureau, then go out to the courts and see what happens. Well, these two particular cases went all the way to Supreme Court. So the first one is actually kind of interesting. So the first one is Rutherford v. U.S. And in this case, the individual was sentenced with some stacked 924C, the possession of a firearm in commission of a drug or violent offense, possession or use of a firearm during the commission of a drug or violent offense. And that, under the First Step Act, that stacking changed, right? But Congress didn't make it retroactive. So folks moving forward are sentenced differently. So this individual Daniel Rutherford. He was the petitioner. He filed for compassionate release using the extraordinary and compelling circumstance and said the extraordinary and compelling circumstance was if I had committed the same crime today, I wouldn't have received as much time because Congress amended this in the First Step Act in 2018. Went through the process, went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that if Congress didn't make it, the fact that Congress didn't make it retroactive doesn't make it extraordinary and compelling. Congress, you know, how often do we see stuff with the Sentencing Commission? And the first question everybody asks is
it retroactive?
Was it made retroactive, right? And for those who don't know, the commission will first pose recommendations and will go through the process to determine, to see if they're going to be accepted, right? They make recommendations. They put them out there. Congress has a certain amount of time to either do nothing and they go into effect or to vote and intervene and shoot them down. After something goes into effect, then the commission considers retroactivity. And retroactivity takes a majority vote on the commission. So we've had some recent ones just this past year where, you know, the vote was taken and it was not made retroactive. So this question of does the lack of retroactivity rise to the level of extraordinary and compelling? And the answer is no, according to the Supreme Court, at least as it applies to Congress. And it said when Congress declines to make a sentencing amendment retroactive, as was the case in this 924C issue, the resulting sentence disparity cannot serve as extraordinary and compelling. And in that case, I believe, yeah, that was, and I thought, let me look very quickly. Yes. Anyway, so that's what they decided, is that's not extraordinary and compelling under the compassionate release clause. So that was interesting. Second one was Fernandez versus the United States. Now, this one, from my perspective, was a little less interesting, but still, it was an attempt to use the compassionate release, extraordinary and compelling, in a different cause. In this case, the petitioner, Joe Fernandez, was involved in a 2013 case involving some gang-related deaths. He went through several methods of appealing his case, both technical and the jury got it wrong, I'm innocent, right? When it got to filing for a compassionate release, he argued that the compelling and extraordinary circumstances was that he was innocent. And the court came back that a prisoner who collaterally attacks the validity of his conviction must proceed with a 2255, which is typically that's how a person appeals their conviction, rather than the supposed invalidity of the conviction is not extraordinary and compelling. So essentially, if you haven't won on a 2255, you can't, as a last ditch effort, file a compassionate release. Being unsuccessful with appealing your conviction is not a grounds for it. So, not as interesting. I would kind of go, well, yeah, of course, that's what the 2255 is for. I did find the retroactivity one to be really interesting, because we, like I said, that question of retroactivity comes up pretty regularly, usually with the Sentencing Commission, but it does make sense. Now, the court did not address the Sentencing Commission. And if the Sentencing Commission doesn't make something retroactive, does that raise to the level? Now, of course, if someone were going that route and it eventually makes it, you can expect district courts and circuit courts to look to this statute to to look to this decision for some underlying arguments of maybe why they it wouldn't raise to that level. But the fact that it isn't Congress, it's an administrative body that didn't make it retroactive, that could be a line of that could be a line for someone. So be interesting to see where that goes. I see that not the end of that discussion. Okay, so we're going to start with the time we have remaining. We're going to start tackling some of these different policies. And we'll see how far we get, because there's a few. So there was a change notice issued on the inmate security designation and custody classification. I found it kind of interesting. And so for those of you not familiar with the designation process, there is statutory language that gives the Bureau the authority to designate an individual. They are required to use the five-factor review. The same five factors that we talk about in Halfway House are the same factors we use in discussing actual designation to an institution. That's what the whole change of the Second Chance Act was we use it the same way. So this one added to that. And it makes reference to the fact that designation, redesignation of the place of imprisonment consistent with the statutory in 18 U.S.C. 3621B, that's where you're going to find the language regarding the five-factor review, requires the Bureau to designate a person's place of imprisonment subject to several factors. It then goes on to say that 28 U.S.C. Section 509 provides that all functions of all officers of the Department of Justice and all functions of the agency and employees of the Department of Justice are vested with the Attorney General. And if you've ever looked at a judgment and commitment order, it says that the person is committed to the authority of the Attorney General.
Right.
And because the Attorney General himself or herself doesn't have a jail in their office, right? So when someone is committed to the authority of the Attorney General, the Bureau is the designated agency for holding them for their term of incarceration. So that's what that language is about. But then it goes on to say that in certain circumstances, the Attorney General may exercise authority to designate or redesignate the place of imprisonment consistent with the requirements of 18 U.S.C. 3621B. Notice of the Attorney General's intention to exercise vested authority to designate or redesignate the place of imprisonment shall be provided to the Bureau of Prisons as soon as practical. Absent such notification, procedures for making classification, designation, and redesignation decisions are, just as described herein, should be followed by the Bureau. When the authority to determine the place of imprisonment is invoked, the Bureau shall provide relevant information in order to facilitate the determination. The Bureau may also facilitate communication or correspondence between the inmate and the Office of the Attorney General. Basically, this is saying that, hey, we're just adding into our policy that this other statutory authority out here that says our authority comes from the Attorney General, well, the Attorney General has the authority to make a designation change. I think it was kind of interesting. You know, there was a whole lot of uproar over the designation of Ms. Maxwell from an FCI to a satellite camp, although because
men
of her
women are different.
Because of her sex offender status.
Yeah.
And of course, policy allows the sex offender PSF to be waived. As we all know, any of us who've been around any length of time, PSFs for sex offender aren't typically waived. Female offenders are different than male offenders. I think it's fair to say I've never seen a male sex offender had his PSF waived ever. I'm not sure I've seen a female's ever waived either, but I am getting old and it's, you know, our Carswell days were more than two decades ago.
Yes, yes.
But it essentially says, hey, the attorney general can override and make a decision, and the bureau is going to follow that decision. And the attorney general needs to provide notice to the bureau as soon as possible. But hey, the attorney general has some authority to do this. Thought it was interesting. I would have rather seen the new security designation manual issued, having been involved in that work group prior to my retirement, seeing the research, seeing the proposed changes. And we discussed some of those in our green book. If you remember, right, in the back of the green book, we actually touched on some of the things that they were looking at in terms of using some of the lessons learned from Pattern, applying program specific completions, not just are you participating in programming, but actually giving individuals who complete programming, like, for example, at the penitentiary level, the Complete the Challenge program. So I think we lost Bruce. So we'll just keep going. Hopefully he comes back. So yeah, I would have rather seen the actual policy be the actual new policy and not just this change notice, but because there's a lot of good stuff in the proposed language, opportunities for someone to work toward getting their security level lowered. So hopefully we see that as well. And that's a big change. And there's a lot to go through. For those of you who've looked at the classification manual, it's a lot of information. So it's not a fast process. Moving on, the receiving and discharge manual. This is one I actually worked on, actually completed the draft while I was still working. Correctional systems was actually part of my section. But the thing I wanted to point out, the specific change was with regard to release medication and personal documents. So the policy now specifically requires that the correctional system staff, and the correctional system staff, those are the men and women who are working in the records, in receiving and discharge. They are the ones that are processing, in processing and out processing individuals from the prison system. One of the problems that we saw was individuals transferring to halfway house or releasing and not being given the medication that they've been taking, understanding that, you know, it may take anywhere from days to a couple of weeks to get a new prescription established at a local pharmacy so that they continue their medication, whether it's blood pressure medicine or cholesterol medicine or diabetic medication, any of those things. And obviously certain things where, say, an individual was getting insulin daily, those things were paid attention to more closely because they were controlled. They were on a regular pill line. But for those folks who just got their prescription and just took their medication on their own, right? They didn't have to go to pill line. They just got the prescription and took it when they were supposed to, much like you and I do, right? So those individuals remembering to make sure that new prescription is issued was supposed to happen. It happened a lot of times, but then it got missed. So one of the things that we put into the policy was the correctional system staff will confirm with health services staff that all medication, medical devices, and or medical supplies are provided, have been provided at least one business day prior to the inmate's release or transfer, and ensure that the inmate receives medication, medical devices, and medical supplies before leaving the institution. Now, it's already in the policy that they get so many days afterwards, depending on the circumstances, either a two-week supply or a 30-day supply. But the problem, and just it's a reality when you're dealing with multiple things going on, is that the paperwork is there, the person's getting released, and the inmate says, hey, where's my medication? I'm supposed to get my blood pressure medicine. And then we're in a situation where, you know, R&D staff are calling over to medical and trying to get a hold of somebody, but we have a bus. We have a bus that is getting ready to leave. So we got a furlough of town driver that's got to take him to the bus station. And sometimes it doesn't happen, right? So this line just put in there that we're doing, that we're requiring correctional system staff to the day before, the business day before, to do a double check. Hey, inmate Jones is leaving on Monday. What is he supposed to have? I don't have anything. Does he have anything as far as medical devices? What's going on? And the goal in that was just to create a smoother process. The other issue, from my perspective, I saw this frequently happen, was persons' personal documents. Now, when you come into prison, if you have a driver's license on you, if you have your social security card, if you have a birth certificate, a passport, any other documents, they will go into the central file, the hard copy inmate central file. What's supposed to happen is when the release paperwork is processed, is prepared by the unit secretary, those documents are supposed to be pulled out of the hard copy file, put with the release paperwork, and go to R&D, receiving and discharge, once everything is signed off. One of the things that I did when I was a case manager was I required the central file to be routed with the paperwork so that I could review the central file. And one of the things I was doing was I was checking for that envelope of personal documents. That's how I made sure that they got out of the file and with the release paperwork and went to R&D. And because invariably what would happen is someone would get to the halfway house and they were calling back to the institution and saying, hey, my stuff's still there. I didn't get it. And then we would be mailing it to the from the institution to the halfway house provider. And then you run the risk of things being lost in the postal service and being delayed, et cetera, et cetera. So again, the policy language updated that said the unit staff will deliver inmates personal identification cards, other personal documents such as birth certificate, social security card, passport, et cetera, to R&D at least one business day prior to the inmate's release or transfer to pre-release custody. Again, this is outlining who is responsible for getting this done. And in the case of the identification, it's unit management that holds those documents. It's unit management's responsibility. Sam, if you're listening to me, Bruce is trying to get back admitted.
Hey.
Oh, there you are. Good deal. Good deal.
Thank you.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you. So while you were gone, we were talking.
Hear, yeah.
You could hear it. Okay, yeah. Great. Great. I got a little concerned that we were just talking about the changes with the R&D manual, which funnily enough, I was actually writing that. I actually finished up my time in the Bureau and went on terminal leave in the spring of 2024. And this was one of the stack of policies that I worked feverishly at to get updated to be on my boss's desk by Christmas of 2023 in the hopes that it would at least start that initial process for review before I left the building. All right. And it didn't. But I was glad to see that was issued. We had a small change in the early release under 3621E. And I think I would call it more of a clarification, I guess. So previously, and this has to do with the DSCC review that happens to determine if someone is 3621E eligible or not. 3621E eligibility, that refers to the early release benefit for completing the residential drug abuse program. And the previous language only stated that DSCC legal staff will review current and prior offenses for both U.S. code and D.C. code felony offenders. And that's what all it said. Review them and make a decision. The language they added in said about for U.S. code cases, DSCC staff will refer to program statement for categorization of offenses. Categorization of offenses goes through and talks about what are considered crimes of violence, what kind of offenses maybe don't meet the exact definition of crimes of violence, but fall under what's called director's discretion. Director's discretion was included in the statutory language that it's actually the director of the Bureau of Prisons who has the discretion to make that decision regarding current and prior offenses and whether someone is eligible or not eligible. So categorization of offense policy has just a laundry list of specific statutes as well as categories of statutes. So unlike the First Step Act, which gave us a laundry list of offense statutes and penalty statutes, but then missed stuff, right? Or had stuff kind of, well, is it this or this? And led to some confusion. Because the way the 3621E language was drafted and put the responsibility on the Bureau to address this, the Bureau actually used a combination of specific offenses as well as offense behavior categories. So for instance, someone who is convicted for a sex offense crime that involves children, the Bureau has, in their discretion, has said none of them are eligible for the time off. It doesn't matter if it fell under this statute or this statute. It doesn't matter if it was actual hands-on physical abuse or whether it was with enticing or over the internet or any of those things. The Bureau got that discretion. That's what the categorization office policy is. What they also said, though, was just to determine for DC code offenses, DSCC legal staff will refer to DC code 23-13-31-4, which maybe in another show we'll discuss that statute. But that is their crimes of violence statute. What is their definition? And I would say it is more generous than categorization of offenses. That's what I would call it more generous. I think there is additional opportunities for someone who's convicted under a DC code to get the time off, be eligible for the time off versus maybe someone who was similarly convicted under U.S. code and is falling under director's discretion. But that was the one change in that policy. We are getting really close. I'm not going to talk about, I think we're not going to, because we've only got 5 minutes left. I'm not going to tackle those. They actually issued a lockdowns and modified operations policy. thought this was super interesting, and it's a discussion all on its own. But I think it was important. A lot of the things that are in this policy were probably previously in the Correctional Services Manual, which is not publicly available. So them kind of creating a separate policy, kind of funnily enough, saw some comments, won't name the names, by another individual in the consulting space who thought it was kind of silly that the Bureau put in the policy that when an institution's on lockdown, individuals are going to, you know, have this many opportunities to shower during the week and staff need to make rounds hourly and a hot meal a day. Clearly that individual, who's retired BOP, was not at an institution with lockdowns, because having come from a penitentiary, we were required to serve at least one hot meal a day. I mean, that was how it was. We were required to make rounds because individuals were locked in cells. We were required to put eyes on them and make rounds. We were required to identify, you know, days a week for out of time where they could, you know, now they had showers. Well, they had showers on, they didn't have showers in the cell. So they had to be, we had to arrange for times for them to come out and shower. And this policy, one of the things is showering 3 times a week, and which is not onerous if you're the individual locked in a cell, right? But he kind of poo-pooed on it because this is going to put all this work on staff. But, you know, I'm guessing he was never at an institution that had lockdowns, or in so infrequently had lockdowns, or for any extended period, didn't realize that a number of these elements were already in the policy. They just weren't in a publicly available policy. And I think in terms of accountability, and, you know, the director and the deputy director talk a lot about accountability and transparency and putting things out there. So in that regard, I think this policy was really good. We'll talk about that next time. Other policy we're going to talk about next time, because it is too much to get into, is the FSA Assessment Programming Incentive Policy. Now, this is technically a new policy. And again, I was involved in part of this before I retired, actually about 2 months before I left the building. And this version, I'm not happy with some of the changes that are in there. And I think, and we're going to spend some time talking about it.
Okay.
Because I think it has the potential to negatively impact vendors and their programming and their opt-in status without them even realizing it. So we're going to spend some time talking about this policy next time. So we'll hold up. And then, of course, you know, there's Supreme Court cases still coming out. We'll probably see more policies coming out. I don't know how quickly, but we're going to kind of do part 2 updates on our next show. Of course, you and I will be out of pocket next week.
Next week, right.
So for people who haven't seen it, we'll put a notice up on our Facebook group. We are going to run this as an encore episode next week, so you get all of this stuff. And then in 2 weeks, we're going to tackle the new FSA policy and the new lockdown policy, and then whatever else that comes up. So,
All right.
So, well,
good job.
That is very close to a wrap. Of course, we've got the new book, the Red Book. It has been out now for about 2.5 weeks now, I think. I can't remember what day we put it out. Excellent book. I think there's a lot of folks who are going to benefit from this. We put a post up on our Facebook. Maybe we'll, when you upload this to YouTube, we can put a link in there for that. But we've also taken all 3 books, put them together as a series, as a book series. So when you go to Amazon, you can go right to the series page, pick up all 3 of them as a set for your loved ones, for yourself, to educate yourself and supporting your loved one, or sending them into the institution. They are
awesome.
Go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was going to say awesome.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and like our Facebook page, come to that, our YouTube channel, First Step Act, and yep, follow us, like us. So appreciate everybody's support, and we'll see you back here in 2 weeks on Around the Block. So take care, everybody. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Gittings, only on LA Talk Radio.